Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, April 2nd, Joe was out and Sarah LeDuc hosted. She was joined by communications expert and founder president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
We are now going to discuss the Maryland man, this is from the New York Times, who is in the United States legally and was deported to El Salvador and imprisoned there because of an administrative error. Trump administration officials said in a court filing on Monday that the American courts lacked the jurisdiction to have him released. The man, Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, has lived in the United States under protected legal status since October of 2019. His wife and five-year-old child are both U.S. citizens. On March 12th, Mr. Abrego Garcia was stopped by immigration agents who told him inaccurately that his status had changed, according to court documents. Mr. Abrego Garcia had withholding from removal status, which means he was the subject of a deportation order, but was allowed to stay in the United States because of the likelihood that he could be harmed if he returned to El Salvador. 3 days later, Mr. Abrego Garcia was deported to El Salvador. He is now being held in its terrorism confinement center, so-called mega prison known as CECOT. In the court filing, Trump administration officials said there was nothing they could do to correct the error, given that Abrego Garcia was no longer in U.S. custody. During a briefing at the White House yesterday, Caroline Leavitt, Mr. Trump's spokeswoman, defined the deportation of Mr. Abrego Garcia, telling reporters the administration had evidence that he was a convicted member of the Salvadoran street gang MS-13, even though he has never gone to trial or pleaded guilty. In Monday's court filing, administration officials balked at the request to return him, claiming that U.S. courts did not have jurisdiction to order such actions and saying that his plight should not stand in the way of the Trump administration's greater foreign policy goals. In a post on X, Vice President J.D. Vance defended the deportation, claiming that Mr. Abrego Garcia was a convicted MS-13 gang member with no legal right to be here. His lawyers have rejected any suggestion that he was and a gang member. We've not in the media seen evidence that he was. It is claimed by one side, not by another. Leave us discuss, I think, first with our immigration attorney, Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, this is not unique to the Trump administration. First of all, I just want to say this happens every day in America, all the time. Withholding of removal is the least settled immigration status. We have nearly unrestricted discretion to the Attorney General by design in the statute and by extension, the Department of Homeland Security, CBP. These officers make decisions every day without the benefit of a very rudimentary understanding of immigration law and policy. I've regularly had to have conversations with Border Patrol and or Immigration and Customs Enforcement about their errors in either attempting to take a client into custody, taking a client into custody, or in detaining a client unlawfully and or deporting them. This is not new. The silver lining, this is where I get really cynical, after 20 years of being an immigration lawyer under five administrations and four presidents is five states. The truth of the matter is that our system is so broken that this barely makes the news when Trump isn't president. And when he's president, people care. So the silver lining for immigration lawyers is that although we are being specifically targeted by presidential actions that say that we should be held under, you know, brought up under disbarment and ethical ethical hearings for our conduct representing immigrants, that is not the silver lining. That's the dark part. The silver lining of that is that people care again about immigrants, which really was a struggle to get people to care, even Democrats who were dealing with directly impacted constituents over the last 4 years. So I'm glad people care, but everyone should know that this happens all the time. All the time. I can't count on all my fingers and toes the numbers of people who had status who were actively being deported that I had to step in and assist.
100%. I know that that's true and accurate. I think one thing that sets this apart is that the federal government is now paying millions of dollars to a foreign country to house these people in the most deplorable and egregious human rights violations prison cells.
There's always a difference under Trump. Thank you for highlighting that. Keep going. But yeah, under Trump, it's just so bad that it makes the news.
Right. And a facility that has hundreds of deaths affiliated with it in just, you know, in months, over months of time, not decades of time. Right. So, I think the difference is we have sent a person away. We are paying for their incarceration in a foreign country in a place where we expect the person to not survive with their life. And then we're saying, oopsies. But we're going to keep paying. And we will allow it to continue to likely end his life.
Although
I think what comes forward.
I will say that there's a distinction without a difference in that for asylum seekers, it's essentially the same thing. When we deport an asylum seeker to a country that they are specifically targeted in, they die. And so it is different that it's systemic. I mean, there's a lot of things.
I mean, one's in a cage and one's not in a cage.
No. The other one who's not in a cage is also dead because their attacker found them. Because there are tons of cases. I've been obsessed with one for a long time, the case of Maria S., who said that she would, if she were deported, that her abuser would kill her. He knew exactly where she was. I think he was a police officer. He had some kind of power and connections. She was literally in the
border
zone.
Which country?
I cannot remember.
Okay, I'll look it up.
That's my trauma brain. And She told the ICE officer who was escorting her out of the country, I am going to die. And she was dead like four days later. So like it is different under the Trump administration because it's especially cruel. You know, the family separation policy, which they denied in the summer of 2018, which ultimately came to light as an official policy to deter migrants. They've shifted from deterrence to just outright, like, we need to grow our numbers, and that's where this is coming from. Another distinction that's very important is that ICE is canceling visas, including student visas, unilaterally. It doesn't cancel the status. It's important to know that. But they're removing the visas, which is the only proof that you have of whatever status you are conferred by the government. So it's especially cruel. It's especially terrible. And that's why it's the only silver lining is in its cruelty, because then people care.
Either Bob. Bellafiore.
How did we get here? I feel like David Byrne on so many of these things. My God, how did we get here? How did we get to a situation where the migrant issue is so difficult, the status of people is so problematic? Because it's fine to sit here and say how bad it is, but it's like, how do we go back and figure out how this happened, right? And what is so broken about our immigration policy? And then how does it get fixed? What's Congress's role, right? We're talking about congressional oversight. I mean, the last president, I mean, was it W who tried to get an immigration bill passed, right?
Well, it wasn't him. It was the Gang of Eight.
Yeah, okay. So, like, how do we solve this? Because this situation with Mr. Garcia is awful. And the thing with his family is totally tragic, right? But unless we fix the whole thing, it's going to be collateral damage.
You're 1,000% right.
You mean let's talk historical context, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, go back to Reagan when we started to see the vilification of I mean, you could go way back. I mean, we've vilified immigrants almost our entire history.
The very first law was called the Chinese Exclusion
right.
Act.
Exactly. So
it's inherently racist.
It has been in definitely an issue in this country. I will also note that this is a failure of Congress to act. All right, that they have been unable and frankly unwilling to create the type of legislation that would bring clarity for folks that are looking to come to this country, folks that are looking to stay in this country, our business community. I mean, nobody knows what's going on right now with our immigration. I would also note that there was a bill which was passed under, you know, which was making its way through Congress that Trump put pressure on, particularly the House, prior to the election, so that it was killed. And I had some serious concerns. I'm sure, you know, I would defer to Nick and Sarah on this, about their concerns about, you know, Langford's bill. But at least it brought some clarity to the immigration situation. What really bothers, you know, when in addition to everything that's being said, that I don't want to lose sight of is A, the tactics that are being used, the use of unmarked vehicles, of in tactical gear, grabbing people off the street. The idea that, oops, this is an administrative fault and there's nothing that we can do, that's garbage. And you know, in Bob's simple mind, this is a criminal activity that the agents and attorneys who are involved in this on behalf of the government should be charged criminally with. All right, that's Bob's opinion.
That's you, Bob, not me, Bob.
Right.
Bob Griffin.
It's Bob's opinion. And again,
Bob Griffin called his own small Bob brain in his own head.
No, I have one too, but these I just wanted own. To make sure that was it.
No, I mean, we're talking about there are so many issues that are linked with this, and the idea that, you know, we're powerless to get this person back and fix this, to fix this mistake, to fix this it's critical that we do make a stink about this and we fix it, because these administrative mistakes, if they get away with it, I have no faith that it's not going to continue. And eventually it's not going to be administrative mistakes around immigration. It will just be disappearing of people. This is how it starts.
I mean, it's there have been a lot of problems. In 1996, there was the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act passed under President Clinton and Democrats. And it was one of the most damaging pieces of immigration, quote unquote, reform for immigrants in America, followed up by W, who after 9/11 abolished the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, and turned it into a new agency, which is the Department of Homeland Security. Most people don't realize the Department of Homeland Security is only a couple decades old, right? And then you know, baked into the statute is that the Attorney General has unrestricted power. And this has been for a long time. The Attorney General has nearly unchecked and unrestricted power when it comes to immigration. And the immigration judiciary is not an independent judiciary. It is right under the Department of Justice. It is in the executive branch. There is a DOJ seal above the judges. So when you appear as an immigration attorney, you're up against a DOJ judge, quote unquote, and then your opposing counsel is from the Department of Homeland Security. There is no planet in which you are an immigration attorney and you're not against the government.
And to add to that, let's be honest about it. We have never funded, we have never put the bodies in place to even address a tenth of the workload. So again, this is another example of the games that get played and the games that are going to be played at the entire federal government level of, oh, I'm sorry, we can't implement the laws that are in place because we don't have the people. Again, these are choices that are being made, and Congress is going along with it, and the executive branch is going along with it. It's a game that denies people even the basic access to their rights by claiming that there aren't enough administrative immigration judges.
And the bottom line is, we did that. I mean, we can yell at Congress all we want, but we elect them.
We do.
And every election cycle, immigration becomes a divisive topic. We allow it. We allow them to lead us to believe that our neighbors are our enemies, that the people who come to our churches, that play with our children, that, you know, and I shouldn't even say our, that we are divided, period. And we allow that to happen with the messages. And then we think, oh, maybe this is dangerous. Maybe I can't, trust the person next door.
Look at the character assassination that's occurring by the Vice President of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, basically saying, just ignore this. It's a gang member.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, again, oh, they're eating cats
but
and dogs.
But that's the dehumanizing.
It is the dehumanizing. But people just need to understand is that this is all part of the way the government is operating right now. You can't trust the government.
Well, I do think, and back to the silver lining starting point, that we are seeing this elevation of attacks on our college campuses, and I do think that is going to ignite a very strong response. We have they started with deporting people for protesting a war, and there was some level of comfort in some pockets around that concept, even though, as Sarah mentioned in a break, that we had no problem with Proud Boys shouting anti-Jewish slogans with tiki torches and other Sarah
on the campus,
UVA. As well. And there's no conversation comparing those two scenarios. But locally and across the country, students with just regular visas are having student visas revoked with the intention of removing those students. They've paid thousands of out-of-state tuition. They have contributed to the communities on their campuses and in the communities where those campuses are housed and located. And I don't know that we've ever had a national conversation around whether we have any discomfort with college students coming from abroad. And that's a new topic that is going, I think, to escalate the immigration debate in a uniquely Trump era way.
I really hope so. But what was really devastating, and this is why I can't practice immigration law anymore, when ProPublico released the tape of the babies who were separated from their parents in the summer of 2018 crying for their mothers, and it received nationwide attention, what changed? If those babies crying out for their parents didn't move us as Americans, this is why we need Cory Booker. It was a sermon. It wasn't a singularly or solely performative act. It was a call to return to our values.
That was Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 2nd. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, April 3rd, Joe was joined by Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Investment Banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
Yesterday was Liberation Day. This has been talked about for several weeks as the President said that this would be the greatest day in American history. And I believe even likened it to the Declaration of Independence, I believe. I want to get the exact words, but I don't have them. I had them on my notes on another page, but that's okay. President Trump said Wednesday that he will impose a new 10% tariff on all imported goods, along with higher import taxes tailored for each of about 60 countries that his advisors say maintain the largest barriers against U.S. products, and a sharp turn toward the kind of protectionism that the United States abandoned nearly a century ago. To impose the new tariffs, the president declared a national emergency, citing the annual merchandise trade deficit that the U.S. has run each year since 1975. For decades, our country has been looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered by nations near and far, both friend and foe alike, Trump said. But it is not going to happen anymore. The Trump tariff increases that the president announced had little modern precedent and would erect towering impediments to products from dozens of foreign countries, many of them poor nations that embraced exporting as a tool to escape grinding poverty. American importers, for example, will pay an additional 34% tariff on products from China, some of which already face 45% fees. Vietnam, which the administration says has become a transshipment point for Chinese companies seeking to dodge U.S. tariffs, will see its goods be hit with a 46% tariff. Cambodian goods likewise will be charged an additional 49% levy. Canada and Mexico, at least for now, face no new trade penalties, but of course were hit early on in this process. High tariffs and a range of other practices, including currency manipulation, value-added taxes, and product safety regulations, explain why the U.S. buys so much from the rest of the world than it sells to foreign customers, according to President Trump during a Rose Garden ceremony featuring a hard hat-clad union worker group, along with lawmakers and journalists. Erasing these persistent imbalances in global trade, which have hollowed out factory communities and weakened national defense, is now official U.S. policy, according to the executive order that the president signed on Wednesday. This all from the Washington Post, by the way. Speaking in blunt, sometimes intemperate language, the president assailed the nation's trading partners, including some of its closest allies, as foreign cheaters and foreign scavengers who had ripped off Americans for 50 years. Trump's tone echoed the dark portrait of American carnage that he had sketched in his first inaugural address in 2017. The early reaction from mainstream economists and business groups was grim, while industries that will enjoy new protection against foreign competition applauded, although Trump's announcement came after financial markets had closed. I'm sure that was a coincidence. Pre-market trading pushed U.S. financial markets sharply down late Wednesday, and all indicators are down this morning, and the Dow will open in just a matter of moments. In the short run, the effect is probably a recession. It's going to raise the price of so many goods that can't be made in the United States, said economist Brad Setzer of the Council of Foreign Relations. In the long run, it's a vision of the U.S. that is very isolated from the rest of the world. Okay, that is what we will grab onto in the beginning as our setup for this story, and because he's so excited to talk about it, we begin with Mark Whitman.
Yeah. So, Joe, the United States started lowering its trade barriers and tariffs with the rest of the world during FDR's administration. And although there had been fluctuations in the line, it had gone ever lower. And as those lowered, we became the world's wealthiest, most powerful country. And I don't, and many economists and political theorists believe that's not an accident. But if you listen to Donald Trump, right, we are a victim. And now it's time to fight, fight, fight. So he wants Liberation Day. He's going to liberate Americans from their savings and earnings as they pay higher prices for the same, for actually a smaller set of choices of goods. He's going to liberate American corporations from some of their profits as they absorb some of these tariffs and also face the cost of rearranging their business activities to try and minimize these tariffs. He's going to liberate the United States from some of its geopolitical power that comes from our centrality in the world's economy. And who benefits as a result? Well, that's a good question, because if you take the simple definition of a tariff, it's a tax. It's collected by the U.S. government. So government revenues are going to go up. But we know that Trump's intent is to use that increase in revenues to help at least fig leaf cover his tax policy, which is going to enrich corporations and the wealthiest Americans generally at the expense of the less well-off in this country. So he's also liberating us from the principle or the goal of achieving greater economic equality in this country. And also, he liberates us from some of our geopolitical influence around the world. He has already begun to increase the geopolitical influence of large exporters who are going to be desperately in search of markets for their goods, including Canada. I'm sorry, including, well, Canada's one, but more importantly, in a geopolitical sense, China, which just, I think, a week or two ago had, there was an unprecedented meeting between South Korea, Japan, and China at the level that hadn't taken place for years. And it was essentially a planning meeting to decide how to respond to the pending tariffs from the United States. So if Donald Trump's goal was that type of liberation, he's going to succeed. The other thing that makes this even more frustrating is Donald Trump is a serial liar. He's also mercurial. So to take anything he says today as a expression of policy that's likely to continue into the future, even to the end of his administration, would be a huge mistake. And so corporations in the United States and actually around the world will be somewhat paralyzed as they try to figure out what happens here. The other, obviously, we've talked about this before, but it's been interesting to hear Donald Trump's press secretary and Scott Bessent, who, by the way, Scott Bessent I put now in the category with Marco Rubio, is somebody who you thought you respected, but now has been so sucked into the maelstrom around Trump that it's impossible to do so. But Bessent basically said, look, don't retaliate us against us. Take a deep breath. And what he means is, call me or the administration and we'll see what we can work out before you get too panicked. That's part of that implicit message. So the opportunity for Washington now to become even more of a swamp of lobbying and you know, improper horse trading. I mean, it literally, we have increased the pot of gold for nefarious dealings in Washington by multiples.
So here's my question, and we'll go to the rest of the group in a moment, and whoever wants to field this, actually. But none of this, as far as the general public and the market certainly, have reacted well to the early tariff announcements from this administration. And I'm just wondering, when you see what has happened and the reaction, and often then the turnaround by the administration that said the tariffs are on, the tariffs are off, the tariffs are on, the tariffs are off, of what then would possess you to say, well, let's make April 2nd Liberation Day, and we're going to do everything we did to these disparate places, and we're going to do it to everybody, of how that makes sense.
Yeah, my true belief is that Donald Trump and some of the theorists that he deals with have a profound misunderstanding of how the world works. And I don't know how firmly they believe it. I believe this. I think Donald Trump realizes that this, again, makes him the center of attention in a way, particularly globally, both domestically and internationally, in a way that almost nothing else would. And I think for him, that seals the deal. Look, Donald Trump was elected to try and deal with the malaise of Americans' affordability crisis, homes, cars, education, medical care. He has done nothing to address those in any meaningful way, and this will exacerbate those crises. He and the Republicans are going to ignore the consequences of this at their own peril.
So there's, I think part of what makes this so dangerous and scary, honestly, is that it's an authority that the president wields with absolutely no check. I mean, there's a the theoretical check of Congress, but they granted the president this power. They could pull it back. They could specifically cancel all of what he did yesterday. But that's not in the cards, right? He enjoys too much support in Congress. But that means it all, the policy is whatever comes out of his head on any given day, at any given hour of any given day. There was some coverage of the behind-the-scenes debate over what they were going to announce.
Yes.
They decided, okay, well, let's do 20% across the board just so everybody knows, like just to have a blanket thing that encourages reinvestment in the U.S., and then we'll have customized rates for certain countries. Well, then they decided, no, maybe not 20%, 10%. How about 10%? It's whatever he wants to do. There's no like theoretical groundwork behind this.
No data was involved in this decision.
No, there was data involved. Apparently, they sort of back-ended their way into these rates by taking a combination of the trade deficit, the existing tariffs, the whatever VAT taxes. Like, it's a mysterious formula. Some people reverse engineered it and they figured it out. But the mercurial is too weak of a word for this. It's because, as you just indicated, he could back off on all of these decisions tomorrow. If he does that, will we all breathe a sigh of relief? Not necessarily, because he could put them back on the day after. And really, I'm not necessarily optimistic that this is how it's going to play out, but if things get bad enough, Congress might actually step up and call the whole thing off. But it might have to wait until this Congress is unelected.
But he would,
which means we have to wait 2 years.
Well, but
two
he would veto that bill, though.
I mean, we have seen. We have seen the Senate just in the last 24 hours, at least four Republican members who have spoken out against some of the tariffs and trying to reduce those. But that's a far cry from then going to the House.
Yeah, you'd have to get past. You'd have to pass legislation. There are two.
Well,
there are two ways.
If it gets bad enough, you'll get 2/3 votes.
Yeah,
to override.
I think that's extraordinarily likely. There are two ways to foil this sort of mechanically within our system. One is to get a veto-proof majority in both houses. Highly unlikely. The other way to do it is to go to court, and I think this is more likely, and say, look, we gave you "quote unquote" emergency power, but for instance, you're levying billions of dollars, I don't know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars worth of tariffs on Canada because there were 42 pounds of fentanyl that crossed the border in the last year. I'm going to get – those numbers aren't exactly right, but you get the point. And any reasonable person – I mean, if you got 10 reasonable Americans in the room and said, is that an emergency that justifies what we've done, the answer is hell no. So that's the other way to come at this. I'm surprised – and my understanding is somebody's already – on the route to trying that in court, but I hold little hope that either of those two solutions will be effective and timely.
Judy Patrick.
So it's the instability of it all, I think, that's so shocking. What we're hearing today from people around the world is they were anticipating these tariffs, but they didn't know they'd be so egregious, so high, so blatant. You know what? I kept on saying to myself, why are we doing this? And the ostensible reason is to bring manufacturing back to the United States, to increase manufacturing. And I agree, there's a place in our economy for manufacturing. But as someone who comes from a long line of mill workers, let me tell you that the job of a mill worker is not a fun job. It's physically demanding. It's mentally demanding. The wages are not great. I mean, I understand that some of those auto plants in Detroit, they all make healthy wages, but I can't see the condos in Saratoga Springs that have been converted into from old knitting mills being returned to paper mills. The paper mills in Greenwich aren't coming back. We do not have low employment. We have a fairly good, healthy labor market. So who's benefiting from this? I think the big businesses will benefit. And I think he, as the American-made business, I think there's going to be some money that will flow their way. But the consumer, like as a consumer, it's a lose-lose-lose. I saw a CNN poll where 5% of Americans somehow think these tariffs are going to lower costs. Like, I want to talk to those people. Why? How? Where is this going to happen?
Judy, on a net basis, American corporations will not benefit from this. You know, the weird thing about this policy, and I heard this expressed, I should credit someone other than me, it may have been at the Financial Times, said that the costs of globalization, if you think about it, benefited everybody. We all paid more. We paid less for blow molded plastic toys, and then for knit goods, and then for electronics. And the costs, unfortunately, were borne in the United States in very localized, mostly internal towns that where the production, manufacturing, whatever you want to call it, was hollowed out. The problem with Donald Trump's policy is he's inverting that. Everybody's going to pay much higher costs for their goods. Unfortunately, you can't bring back labor in the same way. Number one, it takes a couple years to build these factories, and you sort of need a 10-year runway of visibility before you make that investment. And he can't offer that given the inherent uncertainty of both his policy and the next administration's. And beyond that, there is a secular global decline in manufacturing jobs. So you think about Germany. Germany, if we were in Germany, we would be having today a discussion about the secular decline of our manufacturing sector. Why? Because as automation takes over, it's just inherent that people have replaced people with machinery. And I'll give you a great example. I've been through hundreds of tours of food manufacturing facilities in my career. And for the first 10 years, you basically, through the production of this, so let's say cookies were rolling off the line, you'd see these enormous machines and maybe 5 or 6 people who were looking at the computer screens making sure everything was working. You'd see 5 or 6 people, maybe 10, 15 people loading material on, and then another maybe 20 people in the packing area because the machinery for the packing area was really hard to get right and needed a lot of labor. Over the decades, that packing area now has 3 or 4 people looking at computers. The robotics folks have figured it out. And that's just the way the world's going to go no matter what Donald Trump tries to do with trade policy.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, April 3rd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, April 4th, Joe was joined by former EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for The Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and Professor of Economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti. In the segment we'll share this morning, Aaron Pasitti discusses the potential effects of Trump's tariffs on the economy.
For those of you keeping score at home, you'll remember that Wednesday afternoon, after the markets closed, the president celebrated Liberation Day on the Rose Garden lawn, and with a lot of pomp and circumstance and tulips. He announced these tariffs, which ultimately meant 10% tariffs across the board, and then showed this chart, which I said yesterday looked like a leaderboard at Bedminster, but it's now been pretty much debunked, as most of the numbers on it are not accurate. However, It still was used as the prime exhibit A as to what was going to happen. Well, then Thursday came in, and that just set off a flurry of activity. And a flurry makes it sound like it was fun, but it wasn't. Financial markets took their steepest one-day decline since 2020, which was, of course, the pandemic. Investors, companies, ordinary Americans fretted about rising costs from an onslaught of new tariffs. U.S. stocks closed down sharply, with tech-heavy NASDAQ falling close to 6% for the day and about 17% from its mid-February peak, with Apple, Google, and others all posting big losses. The S&P 500 notched its biggest one-day drop since summer of 2020, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, closing down 4.8%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 4%. Major indexes in Asia and Europe also took a fall, though some recovered their losses during their trading day. The wave of new import taxes, which are expected to cost U.S. consumers and businesses hundreds of billions of dollars this year, threatens to radically alter the economic outlook. Analysts at J.P. Morgan describe the tariffs as the largest U.S. tax hike since 1968, and economists on Wall Street and beyond begin warning that a downturn is becoming much more likely this year. On top of this, you have countries now in a retaliatory mode and looking to one up. So now China says it will match Trump's tariffs with 34% on U.S. goods. And that is just the beginning. And then in all of this, we also have a jobs report that came out, which shows that job growth is strong amid these worries over tariffs. So there's a lot to make our way through this morning. Aaron Pasitti, I said you would be up first, and indeed, how screwed are we?
Oh, we're beyond screwed.
Okay. All right.
This will be a self-inflicted crisis of historic proportions, and the more I was processing what happened yesterday, the more apparent it became that this is serious, and I don't think people understand the magnitude of how serious this will be, both in terms of their own personal finances, but also over the more medium term, like, say, over the next 12 to 24 months, how serious this is going to be in terms of the economic damage and unemployment we see. And let's remember, we're only 2.5 months into his presidency. So Trump has effectively liberated us from economic prosperity and economic security. That's the announcement. He imposed, on average, a 23% tariff, which is a tax increase across the board. Some countries got hit harder, some countries got hit less hard. But this is the highest tariff rate the U.S. economy has seen since 1909. And it amounts to effectively a 23% sales tax on average for consumers. So I'm not, I'm going to cut your taxes, I'm going to keep inflation down, has seemingly done the opposite. And before I start diving into the specifics, I was thinking most of yesterday afternoon, and I was using my classes as guinea pigs to figure out how best to position this. Where do you start with something like this? And I was going kind of back and forth last night, and it comes down to this. I read the Wall Street Journal's editorial board's piece yesterday on this, and I found myself saying, oh yeah, no, they're right. Those are really good points. And for anybody who knows my politics, the fact that I'm agreeing with the Wall Street Journal editorial board tells us that we are in for some really, really dark times. This is going to, according to my back of the envelope calculation, and it seems pretty consistent with other numbers I've seen, this is going to cost the average person $2,400 a year in higher costs on the stuff they buy. So for a family of four, that's about a $10,000 increase in costs per year. Now, the true cost of that is actually hidden, because when prices go up, some people forgo purchasing a new car. So then you have to deal with an older clunker that needs more repairs. So not only is the cost of living going to go up, but the standard of living for most people is going to go down because of the goods that they stop buying because they become too expensive. That's also going to lead to an increase in the production of lower cost substitutes, which is going to lower the productivity and quality of products that consumers get. This is a declaration of economic world war. That's what this is. He is saying these tariffs are, we're going to be punishing your countries and very likely causing a recession in your country. Thank you very much. So that U.S. consumers can pay $2,500 more for the stuff they buy. This seems like a lose, lose, lose. I don't know how many dimensions of lose you can throw into a sentence. Everybody's going to lose on this.
Well, it got down to the penguin level yesterday.
Yes, I saw. Yeah, no, I saw that.
So, give you a sense of where we're headed here.
Here's the punchline.
They're eating the fish.
Yeah, that's right.
This is going to cost the average consumer per person $2,400 per year. It's going to lead to higher inflation. And not just higher inflation for the goods we buy. This will ripple out through supply chains and affect goods that are exempt from tariffs because they use intermediate parts. The retaliatory tariffs are going to lead to a slowdown in growth domestically and increasing layoffs, particularly for export-intensive sectors like agriculture and a lot of, you know, more sophisticated manufacturing goods and also service providers. So the combination of high inflation and high unemployment and slow growth is what economists call stagflation. And the last time we experienced stagflation was the 1970s. The remarkable thing is that Trump has already conceded defeat on this. He said, well, we're just going to have to grin and bear it. J.D. Vance echoed that. Mm-hmm. Scott Bessent echoed that. Lutnick echoed that. They're already telling the population, we're pretty sure this is going to cause a recession. So consumers are going to have higher grocery bills. I feel bad for anybody that needs to buy a car in the next year or two, because that's going to be the biggest one, because they're high ticket items and there's tariff on top of tariff on top of tariff for that. And we're going to have to deal with higher unemployment, fewer job opportunities. And the administration, who promised lower grocery prices, a cure to inflation, is telling us, well, not only are you going to get inflation, but you're going to get a bonus, which is a recession. And that recession is very, as J.P. Morgan noted in one of their announcements yesterday, this is not just going to be a U.S. recession. This is a global recession. So what he's effectively doing is snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. He inherited the most robust and strongest economic recovery coming out of COVID. The unemployment rate was around 4% for years. Inflation, higher than we want it, but coming down. Strong growth. And now he's undoing all of this. I don't know what his end objective is, and I want to kind of throw this out as a question a little bit down the line. I can't figure this out. Perhaps he's just that ignorant and doesn't know what he's doing and what the effects are going to be.
And another way of asking that question is, who benefits? Who is going to benefit from
this? I think we know, right? This is to bring in massive new revenue to pay for tax cuts.
This is the biggest reverse Robin Hood plan we've ever seen.
Right? And he told us he was going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, the tariffs are supposed to raise somewhere between $600 and $800 billion per year. That works out to pretty much the cost of his tax plan, which is the tax cut, which is around $1 trillion a year. So consumers are paying a 23% higher tax to fund job cuts or to fund tax cuts for primarily millionaires and billionaires.
Right.
Yep. Now, nobody wins in this situation because
unless you're a billionaire.
Unless you're a billionaire.
The billionaires don't seem to be thrilled with this.
No.
But they're going to benefit with their tax cuts.
But their stocks are going to...
Yeah, but their stocks are going to plunge. I mean, the NASDAQ's already fallen an additional 6% this morning.
True.
So... There's a couple theories. He's just that ignorant and doesn't know what this is going to do. Second, this is just a display of dominance and that he's going to use these tariffs as a bargaining chip. But that goes back to the ignorance. It's tough enough to negotiate a trade deal with your two closest neighbors who are allies. Now he wants to do this with the rest of the world? There's just not enough man or brain power in the administration to accomplish that. And there's my hypothesis, which is his objective is I don't believe the tariffs are going to raise revenue. And I'll tell you why in a minute. And this gets into the three-dimensional chess Steve Bannon hypothesis, which is that the goal is to create a global recession. The goal is to create so much economic pain and so much chaos that somehow, and I don't know what the causal mechanism here is, that that will somehow strengthen his position. I see this as more likely strengthening Democrats and saying, like, well, look what your president did, and really diminishing his chances. So it's tough to tell where he's coming from. And I'd like to come back to that in a minute, and feel free to cut me off if I'm just blabbering too much. But before we get into the details, a tariff is a tax on imported goods. So when we buy Nikes.
Or
right?
coffee.
Or coffee.
Avocados.
Avocados, aluminum, steel. Some of those are consumer goods that we buy. Some of those are goods that businesses buy. So this is not just going to raise prices for consumers. It's going to raise prices on businesses by increasing the cost of intermediate goods. So a tariff is a tax on imports. The stated goal of this was to lower the trade deficit. And the trade deficit is the difference between what the rest of the world buys from us and what we buy from the rest of the world. So since the 1980s, we have been buying more from the rest of the world than the rest of the world is buying from us. That's largely policy induced. That's the result of a lot of free trade agreements that has resulted in lower cost consumer goods. It's also allowed U.S. firms to specialize in high productivity things. And we should run trade deficits with some countries we can't grow coffee in the U.S. at the scale that U.S. consumers want.
Although you can grow coffee in Puerto Rico. I need to get this
and,
in.
Well, and
everyone
and,
should
and
buy
Hawaii.
Puerto Rican coffee.
There are goods that we can't or should not be making in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. So we rely on other countries to supply those goods for us, and we run a trade deficit with those countries. For other countries, we want to run trade surpluses, where we're exporting high-value, high-productivity goods and services. Now, on net, the trade deficit represents about 3% of all economic activity. We run a $1.2 trillion goods deficit, but we also run a $300 billion services surplus. The services the U.S. exports to the rest of the world are financial services, IT services like cloud computing, education, healthcare, tourism are all big exports. So the stated argument, we raise tariffs, that'll reduce the demand for U.S. imports, and that'll right these trade balances. It's a simplistic argument that Adam Smith debunked in the 1770s when mercantilism was dominant. And that is, if one country is running a trade deficit, they're losing because another country is running a trade surplus. Free trade, according to economists, and this goes back to the Wall Street Journal editorial piece, is that it gives us lower prices and more choices. We have a wider variety of goods that we can get at a lower cost. But economists largely ignored the downsides to that, which was the number of U.S. manufacturing jobs that have been lost to offshoring. So the intent of what Trump is talking about is correct, that global trade relations have primarily hurt middle-income U.S. workers. That's the cost. The benefit is that we've gotten a wider array of higher-quality, lower-priced goods, and there are ways to fix the global imbalance and create good jobs for U.S. workers without punishing the entire country. Another group that's going to benefit from this are going to be lawyers and lobbyists who will inevitably start lobbying Trump for exemptions for strategic mm-hmm. industries. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have this army of lawyers and lobbyists take over Washington and start petitioning the Treasury Department, the U.S. Trade Commission, the Chamber of Commerce for all of these exemptions. The people who are not going to be exempt and the people who are going to be hit hardest are going to be low and middle income workers because they spend the largest percentage of their income on consumption. Higher income workers have financial cushions, right? They've got surplus income. They've got savings. They can absorb the cost. So people are going to lower and middle income people are going to have to reallocate their budgets and forgo the consumption of a lot of things. Smaller businesses who don't have thick profit margins that can absorb these higher costs, who don't have profits that can hire lobbyists and lawyers to go to Washington, D.C. and lobby on their behalf, are going to be the other main the people who will also suffer the most. Small business owners, car dealerships, middle and low income consumers.
Farmers.
This is remarkably regressive in terms of who it's going to hurt. And I cannot overstress the magnitude of how widespread and how severe this will be.
So I want to get to the other members of this panel. I just want to, a couple of things. One was the full court press yesterday on from the administration of trying to tell us that everything was going to be fine. So they first sent out Peter Navarro, who is an economist, but also an aide and an advisor to President Trump. And he said, we will not negotiate. We are not going to change. These are in stone. Moments later on Air Force One, as the president was headed to Florida to golf, they said, are these negotiable? And he said, oh, yeah, these are negotiable.
Of course they are.
Yeah, these are negotiable. But my favorite is U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick.
That guy.
who said this. European Union won't take chicken from America. Jay. They won't take lobsters from America. They hate our beef because our beef is beautiful.
This is the same guy who also thought bringing textile and sneaker manufacturing back to the U.S. was going to make America great again. Yeah. Sweatshop jobs.
Our beef right. is beautiful and theirs is weak. He said that. He said that. And nobody came over and said, come with us. So that's where we're headed, right? But this gets me into what you said as your first hypothesis, which is they don't know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. No, and I'm going to quote Paul Krugman here. The malignant stupidity yes. is astounding.
Right.
It's yeah. – Scott Bessin and Lutnick are not inherently dumb people. I think they understand that towing the party line is their ticket to this giant tax cut.
Right.
These are billionaires don't care about this. Billionaires can afford a Maserati that costs 50% more. Billionaires can afford a super yacht that now costs $700 million instead of $400 million. They're not going to be affected. So I'm not surprised to hear them towing the party line. It's everybody else who's going to be subsidizing the tax cuts and the consumption that is going to be provided, gift-wrapped, by Congress and the president to millionaires and billionaires.
That was Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, April 4th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.